I don't think it's going to work.
Did you get a new light?
No, not yet. Well, it's working. It's okay.
Don't breathe.
Can my friend see you?
Oh, yes.
That's what I do here. But I kind of think that's the very body that's roamed around the way in the back.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. It's only a minute, so we can start. I'm David Alkeck. I'm the president of this group right now. And welcome you all. Boy, we have an overflow crowd. This is great. I'd like to ask any first-timers? Oh, wonderful. How did you hear about us?
From Rob.
How did you hear about us?
I just Googled intelligent veto.
Intelligent, yeah.
That's right. So they said.
Anybody else? Okay, well, great. We discussed philosophy and things that are related to philosophy, like artificial intelligence, some science,
history,
poetry, architecture, all kinds of stuff. Coming up in 2 weeks, we have a professor of journalism talking about fake news versus real reporting, the role of ethics in journalism. Jim Mueller from University of North Texas. And then December the 12th, we have Political Science, The American Dream in History, Politics, and Fiction. Both of these are pretty, well, and tonight, pretty on the edge of what's going on in our world. We do take off, we don't do the second... the fourth Tuesday in December because of the holidays, and then we'll pick up again in January through
first Tuesday in May.
July, June.
First Tuesday in May.
May, and then we take off for the summer. So tonight, a few little housekeeping things. Don't forget to pay your bill, please. We don't want to be stuck with it. And be sure you take care of your server. Give them a tip. And if you haven't done so, our treasurer will accept your admission. It's $5, $3 if you're a permanent full-time student. Yeah, some are permanent students. Okay, tonight we are delighted to have our ex-president, one of our ex-presidents, Rob Olson, who was born, I understand, in
Omaha,
Nebraska. There's a poker game named after him, named after Omaha. And grew up there, went to school there. His father moved to Dallas when he was 15, and he's been here ever since. Went to SMU, earned a BA degree, cum laude in economics, and an MLA degree with a concentration in philosophy. That's why you are here. At Southern Methodist. He serves as an adjunct professor there at SMU, where he teaches risk management classes. He's also served as an adjunct lecturer at the University of Texas at Dallas and at University of North Texas. He's also active in community service, and I've known Rob a while, but I didn't know he He taught life skill classes to inmates and jailers at the Dallas County Jail as a community service. He is also an author and a research analyst for international risk management, wrote a book or helped write a reference manual, and he writes and lectures frequently on emerging trends in risk management business, specializing in the impact of genetics, artificial intelligence, robotics, nanotechnology on industry and society. All very current topics. So without any further ado, I am honored to have Rob Olson.
Okay, thanks everyone for coming out. Do we need to get those doors, David? Thank you. Okay, so I really got interested in this topic about 10 years ago. I read a book called The Singularity is Near. Keith and I, you talked about that book many times, by Ray Kurzweil, arguably the foremost futurist in the United States. And he talked about the key trends that will revolutionize our society, artificial intelligence, robotics, and those two are quite related. Nanotechnology and genetics. And so I read this book and I was just so transfixed by it. I was like, I just became more OCD than I normally am and started just reading all these books about these topics. And I just thought, this is amazing stuff. So then I decided to apply this knowledge that I was garnering and apply it to the risk management business and see where that took me. So I started speaking on this and writing about these issues. And then I thought, you know, I was a bit involved in the philosopher's room, and I thought, well, why not apply some of these ideas to philosophy? You know, what would Aristotle or Plato think about artificial intelligence? So anyway, that's the area that I moved into, and as well, I'm giving a similar talk in San Antonio in a couple of days, but it's on the risk management side. So when I prepare for one, I sort of prepare for the other one as well. So tonight we're going to talk about philosophy and artificial intelligence. And so the roadmap for today, for this evening, we're going to talk about the exponential growth in technology, talk about weak versus strong artificial intelligence. And the weak artificial intelligence is the intelligence that DeepMind had over when he played chess, when it played chess and beat Garry Kasparov. Or Watson, when Watson beat the greatest Jeopardy champions. And the strong AI is the AI that you and I have as human beings. Being able to have general knowledge, you know, common sense, consciousness, be able to recognize patterns and things like that and make decisions. And robots and artificial intelligence are not there yet. We're going to cover definitions. That's what philosophers do. We talk about definitions, right, David? We're going to cover some definitions. We're going to get into a little bit of robotics and AI-infused robotics, apply some of these concepts to fields such as medicine and transportation, where there are a host of ethical issues, philosophical issues that we'll delve into, and then explore the ethical implications and challenges of these trends. So a couple of technology quotes, and then I think I have a philosophy quote. Never let a computer know that you're in a hurry. That's mm-hmm. That's not a good thing to do. And a computer once beat me at chess, but it was no match for me at kickboxing. And then this is how babies will be born in the future. So one of my favorite philosophers is Bertrand Russell. Many of you are familiar with him. And he talked about the value of philosophy, you know, and some people say, well, you know, that's just all so, you know, unpractical. Why would you study philosophy? It's just the epitome of impracticability. Impractical, what's the word? Impracticability? Is that the word? So here's Bertrand Russell. Here's his quote on the value of philosophy. The value of philosophy, it is to be studied not for the sake of any definite answers to its questions, since no definite answers exist. but for the sake of the questions themselves. Because these questions enlarge our conception of what is possible, and that ties directly with AI. Enriches our intellectual imagination and diminishes the dogmatic assurances which closes the mind against speculation. But above all, because through the greatness of the universe, which philosophy contemplates, the mind is also rendered great and becomes capable of that union with the universe which constitutes its highest goods, its highest good. So from there, we're going to move into the presentation. So AI, artificial intelligence, it's really supported to an incredible extent by this technology revolution, the law of accelerating returns. Okay? So if you take 30 steps on a linear basis, that's going to take you to 30, right? But if you do it on an exponential basis where you have a doubling every time, okay, what's that going to take you to? What number is that going to take you to?
10 billion.
I think you're close, Brian. I think it's 1 billion. 1 billion, 10 billion. Something around that area. It's amazing. And this is a depiction of the exponential growth in CPU speed since the 70s. And this ties into Moore's law. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Carl. So Moore's law is the observation that over the history of computer hardware, the number of transistors on the silicon chip doubles about every 18 to 24 months. Okay. Now you have chips that you can fit, on my thumbnail, you can fit about 20 million transistors. Okay. And 20 to 50 million transistors, okay? So small that you need like a nanoscope. Not a microscope, but a nanoscope in order to see it. And Moore's law is coupled with things like improvements in algorithms, major improvements in algorithms, and those are the programs for computers to design to solve particular problems, mathematical programs. And the number, the funding for AI has doubled every 18 to 24 months. And then the amount of data that's out there is doubling every year and a half or so, every year, year and a half, okay? So AI craves data, good data, solid data. And we're going to talk about the demon of big data and the weaknesses of big data. We're going to talk about that a little bit. But so Moore's law coupled with these other exponentials, these other dynamics, are what is going to allow AI to really take off. Okay, so computer memory has gotten 10 trillion times cheaper in the past 5 decades. So if you could get that type of discount on your shopping, you could buy all the real estate in New York City for about a dime and all the buildings ever been mined for a buck. Okay, so it's an unbelievable decrease in the cost of this hardware. Okay, so interesting about artificial intelligence is that there was the first symposium on AI was in 1956 in Dartmouth. And in 1956, the year I was born, they talked about AI is going to solve all these problems within 20 years. Okay, so by the mid-1970s, we're going to have AIs that are going to displace all these jobs, and they're going to be able to drive our cars, and there's going to be space tourism, we're going to have flying cars, we're going to have all these amazing things because of AI. And they were talking about strong AI, the type of AI that you and I, the type of intelligence that you and I have. It didn't come to pass. There have been countless AI winners. Okay. What now, my perception and others' perception is that it's really going to take off because of these exponentials that I just mentioned. So I think that's the difference as far as the computer power and all that. But this is the intelligence of machines and the branch of computer science that aims to create it. So an intelligent agent is a system that perceives its environment and takes chances to maximize its chances of success. Okay, so what is going to be the impact on civil analyst jobs in the future? Okay, and that's one of the fascinating questions. You could do a whole presentation on this. There are a lot of experts out there that say that it's going to be depleting jobs within 20, 30 years. And you all are familiar with the Luddites 200 years ago in England that said, you know, all these inventions, weaving inventions and things like that, they're going to take away our jobs and then everyone's going to be unemployed. That didn't come to pass. So my take on it is that it's going to be, this AI is going to reduce the cost of more and more goods, and it's going to free people up to create new goods. There's going to be a demand for that. So it's easy to say AIs and robots are going to take away all these jobs. It's easy to contemplate that, okay? But it's very difficult to contemplate all the new products and the new jobs that are going to come out of that, creating demand, okay? I mean, 100 years ago, would our grandparents, no, great-grandparents, know what we were talking about when we would say, I'm going to be a cyber professional? They wouldn't know what you're talking about. Or I'm going to drive for Uber. They wouldn't know what you're talking about. You know, 70-80% of the jobs that now exist didn't exist 100 years ago. Okay, so it's easy to imagine, okay, all these jobs going away, but it's much more difficult to say, yeah, but think about all the new jobs and new occupations, new products that are going to be out there that we can't even contemplate today. The other factor is when Henry Ford, he introduced all sorts of automated mechanisms, the concern was that that's going to do away with jobs, but actually he could start afford to pay his workers more money, and then they were able to, they had more money, they were able to buy more cars, and the same concepts, in my opinion, will apply in the future. So I'm not a doomsdayer when it comes to jobs and artificial intelligence and robotics. I think it's going to create a higher standard of living. And I think that dystopian ideas that all the jobs are going to go away, I think it's a little bit far-fetched. So I read about these people that develop these algorithms, which I don't do. And one of the first questions they get is, can I use it for the stock market? Can I make money off this, you know? And so it's all, you know, kind of tied into, okay, how can I make money out of this artificial intelligence? And so over half of the stock market transactions on the U.S. Stock Exchange and others are using algorithms. And the idea is to try and mimic circuits in the human brain. And it deals with evolutionary programming, recursive self-improvement. The idea is that we have this artificial intelligence utilizing machine learning where that program gets smarter and smarter and more experienced as time goes by, thus improving the outcome and improving the product. So anyway, AI won at checkers in the early 1990s, then it beat Deep Blue, beat Kasparov in chess in 1997, and then Watson beat Jeopardy, the Jeopardy champs, in 2011. And then earlier this year, he brought us, has anybody heard about this? The Texas Hold'em? Okay, Dan, you heard about it. Okay, so Lebradas, artificial intelligence, robotic, he played the top three world poker champions, top three guys in 2017. Does anybody want to take a guess what the odds were, Vegas odds, as far as who was going to win? You want to take a guess? 3-1 odds that the human beings would win. And the reason, one of the reasons was, well, Lebradas doesn't have complete information. Lebradas can't bluff. We're good at bluffing. Us human beings are good at bluffing. And the chess Deep Blue could see all the pieces on the board, see everything in there, had like quote-unquote perfect knowledge. Lebradas did not have perfect knowledge. And so that's why Las Vegas said, Lebradas is going to lose. Well, Lebradas waxed him because it had every single calculation as far as all the different odds, what these guys had showing in their hand, it calculated all the odds, and it was no contest. And so that's what we talked about. Yes, David?
How about the computer that played Go with the...
Yeah, Go is another one. Yeah, 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 that's right.
It's even more complicated.
Mm-hmm. The chess, yeah. And so with Go, you've got a large board, and you've got all these, you've got, what are they called? Not marbles,
points.
But points, yeah. You put it all over the board. And the thought was that the artificial intelligence robot could not win at Go because Go involved too much intuition. And yet, it won as well. And then that was another issue on the poker. It's like, Lebradas lacks that human intuition that's integral to poker, integral to Go. So with a philosophy group like this, let's just get our definitions out on the table. Many philosophers can never agree on definitions. So intelligence, the ability to accomplish complex goals, artificial intelligence, the non-biological intelligence. Weak AI is the ability to accomplish a vanishingly narrow set of goals, like playing chess or driving a car. Strong eye, the ability to accomplish any cognitive task as well, at least as well as humans. And superintelligence, general intelligence, far beyond human level, also called God in a box or transhumanism. My religious friends might not like that phrase, God in a box. Okay, so this is an amazing document by Hans Moravec, and sort of laying out the landscape for human competence and applying this to artificial intelligence. So areas down here, the lowlands, arithmetic, rote memorization, translation, the Google translation. Is anybody impressed with Google translation? I'm not. We had that issue at ERMI, my company, and I was not impressed with some of the translation it did. So I think there's still a long way to go. Brian?
I have a friend who's very impressed because it translates Chinese into English pretty well.
Is that right? Okay, I saw one in Spanish that I wasn't impressed at all.
Well, I'm impressed because it handles the Cyrillic alphabet, it handles the Chinese alphabet, and it handles the English alphabet, like, with no problem.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So, and it's hard to go between alphabets, right?
Now yeah,
it's
oh, yeah.
So it's not just language.
Yeah.
I've seen Chinese translations of patents, and they just make no sense at all because, you know, the symbols have so much complexity to them.
Right.
That a direct translation doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
So,
interesting.
You don't seem to have an app named correct.
So what Moravec is saying is that if you want to keep your job. You need to be going up from the foothills. You need to be going up higher and higher and higher to these levels of science and book writing and AI design to keep your job. Okay. So these jobs down in the lowlands, speech recognition is sort of in the middle. Go. These are the jobs that are being threatened, like the truck drivers. Their job will be threatened down the road. But the social interaction. The cinematography, Bennett, we have a cinematographer in our midst, book writing, AI design, all these are much, much higher as far as requiring greater creativity, greater common sense, and greater pattern recognition. So I thought that was a really interesting slide. So AI has been written about, and you know, it's such a common theme of science fiction. Strong AI is possible by 2029 per Ray Kurzweil. Strong AI is like summoning the devil, Elon Musk. But Michio Kaku says that it's an end of the century problem. And I tend to, you know, I'm not an expert in the category of these guys, but I tend to agree with Kaku in that I don't think it's imminent. I just think there's too many problems, too many complicating factors, and we're so complicated. Computers are digital. They are on and off. They're zeros and ones and bits. They're analog and they're digital. We're analog and digital. We have electrical impulses. We have, you know, it's been hundreds of millions of years or millions of years, however you want to characterize it, where we've evolved and we have these complex biochemical machinations going on within us, and through they're developed through this amazing progress process of evolution. And I think it's simplistic to say that within 20 years that we're gonna replicate our DNA and our RNA and all the proteins that we have. I could be wrong, but I think some of these concerns are a little bit overstated. It's hard to find a topless picture of Vladimir Putin. But he said whoever becomes the leader in this sphere will become the ruler of the world.
Obviously him, I guess.
Yeah. Now, this is a caption that was created by artificial intelligence. And so how this was done when it started, it didn't know anything about Frisbees, it didn't know anything about young people, it didn't know anything about a park or anything like that. And so it was fed massive amounts of visual data, huge amounts, and it came up with this caption, and it's dead right. It figured out what this was an image of. Okay, so here's AI yesterday. And what was the thing about Frankenstein's monster? Okay, so he had a brain and he had consciousness, right? So then what did he want? He wanted rights, didn't he? He had feelings,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So Mary Shelley wrote this amazing novel. If you've not read the Frankenstein's monster, it's an amazing, amazing book. And here's AI today. Who is this?
Watson.
This is Watson, that one at Jeopardy, right? Okay, so I don't know if this video, Ken and I were playing on this video and see if it's going to actually work.
Developed and programmed especially for this moment, making its first appearance on our national television program. This is Watson. Just as I expected, that was a very warm reception, and I'm sure Watson would have appreciated the applause, except for one thing. Watson can neither hear nor see. It will be receiving all of its information electronically. And as a matter of fact, what you're looking at right now is not the real Watson. This is an avatar. This is a representation of Watson. Watson, of course, is a sophisticated computer system, too big and too heavy to fit behind that lectern on our stage. But it is close by. It's right next door. And a little while ago, I paid it a visit. The very first thing you will notice as I come into Watson's space is noise. There is a lot of noise. A little bit comes from Watson himself, but most of the noise comes from two very...
Uh-oh.
Developed and programmed especially for this moment, making its first appearance on our national television program. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Watson. Just as I expected, that was a very warm reception, and I'm sure Watson would have appreciated the applause, except for one thing. Watson can neither hear nor see. It will be receiving all of its information electronically. And as a matter of fact, what you're looking at right now is not the real Watson. This is an avatar. This is a representation of Watson. Watson, of course, is a sophisticated computer system, too big and too heavy to fit behind that lectern on our stage. But it is close by. It's right next door. And a little while ago, I paid it a visit. The very first thing you will notice as I come into Watson's space is noise. There is a lot of noise. A little bit comes from Watson himself, but most of the noise comes from two very large refrigerator units that help to keep Watson cool. Now, as you can see, Watson has been set up in two units. Each half contains five separate racks. Each of these racks contains 10 IBM Power 750 servers. Now, when you link all of these servers together, as they have done for Watson, you create a deep analytic system that is the equivalent of 2,800 powerful computers tied together in a super high-speed network. It has a memory capacity of over 15 trillion bytes. Let's play Jeopardy. Here we go. Our first round of play contains these categories. Literary character APB, all points bulletin. Beatles people. Olympic oddities. Name the decade. Final frontiers. And alternate meanings. A little while ago, We had a drawing to determine which player would select first. Brad, you won that. So if you're ready, make your first choice.
Let's take alternate meanings for 200, Alex.
Four-letter word for a vantage point or a belief.
Brad, what is a view?
Yes.
Alternate meanings, 400.
Four-letter word for the iron fitting on the hoof of a horse or a card dealing box in a casino. Watson,
what is it?
You are right. You get to pick. Literary character, ADV.
Okay, so that's Watson.
No, Kim, I got to get the air up on there. We're not real high tech here.
Low AI.
Low AI, that's right. Thank you. So with Watson, questions that have missed Sinka and you are scratched, talking about the eight ball. Watson is now going to medical school, using big data to diagnose and treat patients. So the idea is that Watson and doctors will be collaborators. Another goal is to outmaneuver cancer. So imagine, has anybody been out to West Big Bend before? Been camping in Big Bend? Okay, there are going to be doctors out in Big Bend? No, it's very, very sparsely populated. And so if someone was having what appears to be a heart attack out in Marathon, Texas, and there's no cardiologist there, the idea is that down the road, that family practitioner in that tiny community can use Watson as a collaborator, okay? So imagine imagine that you you have cancer and you're oncologist. You expect your oncologist to keep up with the latest medical readings, right? How long would it take an oncologist to read all the medical journals in oncology per week? About 80 hours. Okay. It would take him, just in that area of oncology, or just maybe dermatology, about 80 hours of reading per week. Okay. Well, Watson can do that and imbibe that, and if he's provided the blood work and the diagnostics and various things like that, all the symptoms, then Watson can provide some ideas about what the diagnosis is, okay, to assist that doctor. So the idea is not for AI to be your doctor, or Dr. Algorithm to be your doctor in the future, but that AI, Dr. Algorithm, will be a collaborator with your human doctor, okay? So that would be another tool in the toolkit of your doctor, which I think is a great utilization of AI. But has anybody ever asked Siri silly questions? Am I the only one? Okay, so a lot of people ask Siri silly questions, right? So I asked her the other day, Siri, what are you wearing? I can't answer that, but it does not come off. Siri, do you believe in God? Humans have religion. I just have silicone. But then I asked Siri where the nearest Social Security office was, and she sent me to the nearest post office. I asked her, can a giraffe fit in a car? And she sent me to this giraffe jokes website. Can you answer my question? Can a five-year-old answer that question?
Yes.
A five-year-old knows the answer to that question, right? Has trouble with a Texas accent, and has problems with various issues, and in some surveys it missed about 30 to 40% of the questions. Okay, so tied in with artificial intelligence is robotics. It's intertwined. Okay, so robotics is the branch of technology that deals with the design, construction, operation, application of robots. And the idea is for it to take the place of humans in dangerous environments, operating manufacturing processes. And the goal is to also help that, provide that robot to sort of appear like a human, human appearance, if possible. Why is that important? Why would it be important for a factory worker who's working alongside a robot for that robot to have a smile on his or her face?
Robots, why do you think robots have to look like a human?
There are some manufacturing, industrial ones that don't, obviously. But the goal is, but those have to be programmed, they're very, very complex. But the goal is for robots, and working with industrial psychologists and all that, is that people will be more comfortable working with robots that they feel good about, that they can trust, that are humanoid in appearance. Okay. And so part of it is that, once again, going back to what we call cobotics, collaborative robots. Okay. Would you rather work alongside a robot that looks like Frankenstein? Or would you rather work alongside a robot that looks like Taylor Swift? Well, most of us would probably say Taylor Swift. Okay? So then it's like a matter of trust. Can you trust that robot? Right. So this is an Atlas robot, and I don't know, this is pretty amazing stuff, but you know, our technology here is, I'm going to try and get this to play again.
Click in the middle.
Middle.
Yes.
There it goes.
It's working.
This is in Boston, where they have 5 billion awesome universities, so they have a lot of manpower.
And a lot of snow to practice.
That's right.
He's a drunk.
And now they start being mean to him. Amazon is using more and more robots, not like this one, but using more and more robots. Strong AI, they lack intuition, creativity, common sense, they lack pattern recognition, though you are making some strides in their pattern recognition. They certainly cannot engage in sparkling conversation at a cocktail party. Yeah. Okay, so one of my favorite movies is, would y'all recognize this?
Yeah.
Dr. Strange.
And so the idea is that, one that I don't adhere to at this time, is that AI is going to get so smart, and with recursive improvements and machine learning and deep learning, that it's going to achieve our level of intelligence, and then it's going to be programmed to get smarter and smarter, make better decisions, and so at some point it's at an intelligence that far exceeds our abilities. And it may treat us like, okay, these are like elephants in a zoo, these humans, we'll keep a few of them around. That's the doomsday idea that, and some say that's 200, 300, 500 years off, may never happen. And others say it could happen, Elon Musk, say, in 20 or 30 years.
Trust me.
So what could go wrong? An evil race of robot overlords, and maybe we'll talk about that at the Q&A. Machine learning. Frankenstein's monster said, I can think on my own, I should have rights. And so Woody Allen, I love this quote, Woody Allen, more than any other time in history, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, The other leads to total extinction. Last prayer, we had the wisdom to choose correctly. Okay, so how is this going to apply to medicine? We've got several doctors in the room. The idea is with longevity medicine that you're going to be able to, with AI, that you're going to be able to say, okay, this person has high blood pressure. Right now, you can try all sorts of permutations of high blood pressure medication and all sorts of bad reactions. It's a trial and error process. Is that right, David? A lot of trial and error, okay? The idea is with AI and medicine and with the Human Genome Project, we're going to be able to map your DNA. We're going to be able to know exactly what type of medication you need for your high blood pressure, okay? Or what the exact proper best treatment for your cancer or your depression or whatever it might be. Okay, less trial and error. Okay, there's talk about down the road that there would be nanobots, nanorobots that are the size, you know, nanometers wide, that will go in and attack that cancer, that particular area of your body with the cancer. Okay, the other thought is that really what we're doing wrong is when we're fighting cancer, we're trying to apply massive doses of chemotherapy. And all these things that bombard our bodies. So what we want to do with artificial intelligence and nanotechnology is to out-trick the cancer and find out exactly what type of cancer that is. And instead of trying to throw one bomb after another on the cancer, we're going to outthink that cancer, and we're going to, with gene therapy and these types of things, we're going to show our smarts with artificial intelligence in these other areas. And we're going to solve or mitigate that problem. So you're going to see more and more personalized medicine. So maybe in 20 or 30, 40 years, our DNA is going to, we're going to have it on a credit card, or it's going to be inserted under our arm, just underneath the epidermis, and it'll show everything where we have a bad reaction to, things were surgeries we've had, all of our medical records there. Okay. So this guy may replace some doctors out there, David and Charlie. So there's a lot of ethical issues, longevity issues. Ray Kurzweil says that he hopes that within 20, 30, 40 years with these types of advancements, that people can live forever. Well, just think about the implications there as far as older population and taking care of these people. There's all sorts of privacy implications in genetic testing. There have been laws that have been passed to try and stem that. But what about the anti-humans, neuroimplants, and gene editing for normal people? Right now, I have a friend with Parkinson's, and he has a brain pacemaker that they drilled a hole in his skull and implanted. It was a chip implanted under his skull that modulates his brain activity. It can be done for Parkinson's. It can be done for depression. It can be done in all these areas. What about, though, when normal people say, I want that advantage. I want to be amped so I can get into Harvard and I can start making $2 million a year. That could be something that comes down the road in 20, 30, 50 years. And so then it's like gene editing for normal people. At first, some of these technology will be used on people that are disabled. But then as time goes by, people want an advantage. That's one of the philosophical issues involved here, is this going to become an issue? Okay. And then, you know, I talk to my students a lot about this, the law of unintended consequences. We think we're smart enough to make changes to a very, very complex system. Think about Obamacare and all the issues that were involved in that. Who knew healthcare could be so complicated, right? But it's millions of years of evolution that's brought us to where we're at. And for a computer scientist to say, we can replicate this in 10 or 20 years, even though our DNA is totally different than a computer's DNA, I think it's far-fetched. But it's a combination with Homo sapiens will be a combination of biological and non-biological intelligence down the road. It's possible. And then another issue is I've talked to several of my friends who are doctors about over-treatment or over-diagnosis due to advanced technology. With some of this AI and some of these imaging techniques, they can find so many abnormalities and thinking, okay, this may lead to cancer or this may lead to heart disease. And yet it's finding so many minute abnormalities that In many cases, it's resulting in overdiagnosis and overtreatment of a host of medical issues, including prostate cancer and breast cancer. And so that's the downside of this, is as this technology becomes better and better and better, okay, and the images become better and better, the chances for the false positives multiply. So now let's segue into transportation in the future. Intelligent highways and roads, autonomous automobiles. People are very interested in that topic. And are we going to use AI to learn from these accidents? So what is one of the issues with autonomous cars right now? What are the problems? Does anybody want to throw out an idea about some
liability?
Liability, right? Right. Who's liable?
They all keep crashing.
But autonomous cars, do they drive like human beings?
No.
No, we're kind of edgy, right? We take a few chances. Autonomous cars, they follow the law to the limit, right? And so at a four-way, right?
Yeah, but they don't do very well on rough roads. Or
no, they don't do well snow.
That's right, yeah. So they don't have the flexibility of the human driver.
That's right. And they tend to get involved in a lot of not-at-fault accidents because they can get paralyzed. So an example, one case that I saw, you have a four-way stop sign. And you've got two cars there, you've got a car coming here, and you've got the autonomous car here. If the autonomous car, you know how people just kind of edge into the, you know, into the intersection just a little bit, then the autonomous car freezes. It feels like these cars are going to just take off. So then it freezes, and then the car behind him, it's like rear ends him. So they've been involved in a lot of non-fault accidents. But the idea is, if it's involved in an accident, then what can we teach, even if it's not a fault, what can we teach this car as far as avoiding those types of accidents? So you're going to see more and more. This is sort of narrow AI in many ways, but they have problems distinguishing a child from a plastic bag floating in the air on a windy day. Okay, that's a problem. They have problems with construction zones.
They do well driving trains.
Yep. And the trucking industry in Australia, in the central part of the country, where it's hard to need people, they do real well there. And they're using more and more in the mining operations, right? Farmers are using them a great deal because it's pretty simple as far as where they need to go. Guess how many companies in the world are working on this issue here?
About 10.
Two.
150,
I read.
There's 10 big ones that have vehicles that are available right now.
Wow. Okay, so then on autonomous cars, to get a better feel for this issue, you have to think about these features, like electronic stability control would be one feature, that would be level one, or smart cruise control where the crews realize that you're approaching a car on the freeway too closely, you know, slow down. Combined function automation, adaptive cruise control with automated steering. Mercedes S-Series has that now, but that's a $150,000 car, I believe. Limited self-driving automation, where it's driving for you, but if the conditions turn bad, it turns it back over to you. Okay. So when my mother was alive, I always thought it would be great if my mom could have an autonomous vehicle. But when she was in her mid-80s, she couldn't be in a level 3 vehicle because it would turn her back over to her any time. So that's not going to work. And so what Google has said is that we think it's too hard to go from level 2 to level 3. What we want to do is try and go from level 2 to level 4. We think that this creates just too many issues, too many liability issues. And you're trying to, okay, we're sending back the control of the car to you now, okay?
Put your roof down.
Yeah, that's right. Whereas Ford, Toyota, Mercedes are still moving toward level 3. So that's going to be interesting, very interesting.
That would work for truck drivers, though.
Yeah, might work for truck drivers, yeah.
I thought I saw the Mercedes had a new, the four passengers just kind of faced each other and the car just, you know, was self-automated.
That's a car of the future that they had at the auto show.
Yeah, it was.
That isn't something that's
on the road now.
Yeah, protect
your students. So here's some of the ethical issues. You know, who's going to be liable for these autonomous, for these losses? Right now, the auto manufacturer says it's going to be liable. But what if there's faulty algorithms? What if there's faulty software that from the third-party vendor that the auto manufacturer provided, and they said, well, the vendor didn't do the proper testing. They didn't test during snow, for example. Then there's still going to be lawsuits, recrimination back and forth. And so it could be that there's going to be less personal auto insurance and more commercial auto insurance and more product liability insurance where it's going to go, or maybe go to a no-fault type of system. So there's huge disagreement on this issue as far as who would be liable, and the lawsuits could really take off if you've got one company that provides one algorithm, they have their experts, and you have another company that has their algorithms, and they have their experts. And so, you know, is a jury going to be able to make that decision? I doubt it. Okay, so this is a grandma. I don't know if this is going to do this.
So why is she in that seat? Put her there.
Her grandson was the working on that car.
What is she like when she is?
Okay, so now smart homes. How are we doing on time, David? Okay, so our homes are going to be so different in the next 20, 30, 50 years. You're going to see a big improvement in smart homes. And particularly with the millennials are going to be the ones that are going to be more likely to adopt these features. But desktop fabricators, where 3D printing, basically, you're going to see that's going to become much more common. You can have 3D printing of illegal drugs. There's a host of liability issues involved in that as well. So if you now are a manufacturer and you're doing 3D printing of a product, and maybe it's food, and someone dies because of that food, then where's the liability on there going to fall? Okay, mm-hmm. Is it going to fall on the who did the programming of that 3D printer? Is it going to fall onto the person that engaged in the 3D printing? What about the device that actually did the printing? So there's a host of issues there. And then the dangers concerning robots as well. There's still industrial accidents with robots where people are killed. So this deals with computer ethics and a set of moral problems that are aggravated or transformed by the introduction of computer technology. And so this really gets into things like privacy, it gets into hacking, and AI ethical issues with AI-infused big data. Are we going to use big data for good reasons? Are we going to use it in a way that's going to be deleterious to our society? Okay, so this is a book that I just finished reading about weapons of mass destruction. Fascinating read, because if we will rely on big data too much and focus solely on big data, and that's going to be the driving force, and AI merged with big data, there can be a lot of ethical problems that result from that. For example, Washington, D.C., they were having really poor results in their school districts. And so they decided that they would do this testing using big data, and they would test the children at the end of fourth grade, for example, and then compare them to the end of the fifth grade. And the teachers that scored the poorest on how well those students progressed, the bottom 2% would be fired. Okay, that was the factor. And then the next year, the bottom 5% were going to be fired. But what happened is that you had great teachers that were fired. They had great reviews, but the system can be gamed. Okay, there was rampant cheating that was going on. Teachers were realizing what was happening. They were erasing test scores and putting the right grade in there. Some teachers had students in low income, very low income communities. Others had them in higher income communities. That was an impact there as well. And so if you say big data is king, okay, and you can allow big data and AI-infused big data to make all these decisions, and you're gonna set everything else aside, the chances of cheating, the chances of gaming this system just take off. And another example was Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense in the Kennedy administration. He was just so focused on big data as far as body counts. How many North Vietnamese did we kill today? And that was the measure of success, okay? And what happened is that the generals and all that, they thought that was horrible, but it's like they started gaming the system as well because they wanted to get promoted. It's just sort of human nature. They wanted to get raised. They didn't want to get fired. And so all that data lost all its credibility. So if we focus so too much on big data, with all of its vulnerabilities, it could lead to a host of problems, including gaming the system. The last example is students that wanted to get into Harvard and Princeton and all that. And one factor they were looking at was, how many Twitter followers do you have? And so you can game the system, so you can get a program, and it's going to elevate the number of followers you have by a count of 20 or so. And so, you can game these systems. And so quantitative, relying too much on quantitative data has its downsides. So another issue is the digital divide. Technology haves and have-nots. So we're seeing more and more inequality. And some say, well, it's due to taxing policies and governmental policies. There are others that say it's because some are great with technology and some are being left behind with technology. So there's a host of issues there. But I have a friend who's a pilot, and he said, if this keeps up, I'm going to be forgetting how to fly because it's all an automatic pilot. And factories are becoming more and more automated. And so something goes down, something on that factory goes down, it's like there's a loss of fingertip knowledge. People are forgetting, okay, how do you manufacture this before all these computers and all these robots? Okay? So a loss of blue-collar jobs can happen. We're seeing a loss of single analyst jobs, though we talked earlier about this and how I think there's still going to be new jobs that are going to be created. Things are going to get less expensive. That's going to create demand for new products that we can't even imagine today. But it's still an issue, and many experts in the field feel that we're going to have some type of minimum, standard minimum income or a 30-hour work week. But I don't see that happening in the next 20 years or so. So here's where you have the human capabilities of human workers and computer technologies going up and up and up. But whether it will ever achieve this within our lifetime or our grandchildren's lifetime, as far as that type of strong AI, I have my doubts. So this gets into the whole issue of computationalism. Is our mind nothing more than a computer program? Okay. Our computer program is going to get better and better and better, and they're going to just pass us by. And so what truly is the difference between the brain, our brain, and the most widely powerful computer that we can envision? We talked before about how we are the products of evolution. We've got these biological and chemical processes going on in our brain. We have DNA and RNA and massive amounts of protein. And a computer's not going to have that. And so to suggest that we just need more RAM and we just need better algorithms and we need more firepower behind our computers and they're going to pass us by, I'm skeptical. Okay, in conclusion, the world will be shaped by major advances in computer technology, big strides in AI and robotics as we're seeing. How are we going to deal with these inevitable forces? And our favorite Albert Einstein said, I never think of the future, it comes soon enough. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Rob. Science fiction has become science fact. We're not going to have a lot of time for questions and answers, so please don't get into a lecture or a diatribe. Make your thing into a question. I've read a book, Homo Deus, and the author talks about a discontinuity between intelligence and consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, computers are going to become very, very, very intelligent. I mean, every kind of data, you can put a whole library, Encyclopedia Britannica,
dictionary, everything. They're going to be smarter than us, but will they have consciousness?
Yeah.
That's, you know, can they pass the Turing test? The Turing test is, you know, what the Turing
AI is. Experts call that the C word, consciousness. They can never, no one agree on, they call it the C word. No one can ever agree on what consciousness means.
Yeah, we don't know what that is. Okay. Questions?
I got one.
Hey, Alton.
Earlier you said that, you know, people, they might not lose their jobs yet. But as you might know, in West Virginia, coal mines, the people that vote for Trump, counting on him to keep their jobs, now those mines, you know, the owners are using robots to do their job.
Yeah.
So all those people that used to work there, they lost their job because of robots can do a better job than they are, and it's safer.
Well, one thing you have to keep in mind, though, is that a lot of these workers are going back to school and learning computer technology, and the idea is that these robots need people to work on them, okay? The robots can't do it all on their own. So yes, some of them are going to lose their jobs, but others, it's going to open up possibilities of working with those computers, working with those robots, and so that's the hope. Is that we've been down this road before, Alto, and there's been predictions of mass unemployment starting about 100 years ago. And back in the 60s, it was predicted that with some of these big IBM computers that and more machineries on the farm, that jobs would go away and there'd be fewer and fewer jobs and massive unemployment. That was back in the 1960s, so that hasn't happened. So I think that some of the jobs are going to go away, but I think back to the point I made earlier is that there's going to be new products and new services that are going to be out there that we haven't even contemplated that people will get retrained to do. So there will be some turbulence, but I think there will be replacement jobs for them.
Question?
Yeah. I like the things you covered so far. It's about, I think, the growing pain. But what happened later on, further down, let's say 100 years down the road, well, we already know the experts, they have pretty much consensus that sooner or later we will get there. And it's just not
get,
what
get where?
We will get there.
Where's
this? ASI.
Singularity.
Super intelligence.
Right.
Few of them disagree, meaning the overwhelming majority, they agree within the century we'll get there. And to an extent, that super intelligence can kill us all. There's no question of law. The entire morality, ethics, everything changes. Well, super intelligence, there's no individual thing. They can combine like a cloud and separate those. And they're saying that we have to accept them as our office. We have to
as our masters.
Our office. Yeah. Do we have something to say about that?
I don't buy it. I could be wrong, but I just think that if we can align our goals with this growing artificial intelligence, that and the ability to switch off the machine, I think that that's still going to be a key factor. I have no indications that I see nothing in the near future that indicates that these computers are going to gain consciousness. Okay, just think about our own consciousness and the memories and the fact that we can enjoy a beautiful spring day. We can go out and play pool with our friends and enjoy that. And we can have all these experiences that form who we are. Okay, and we are aware, your mind tells you, Carl, that I'm Carl Meinkenbach, right?
Yeah.
I'm Carl, okay? A computer, doesn't have that type of consciousness at all. So in 100 or 200 years, I could be proven wrong, but I'm going to be dead then. So I just think that these expectations of AI going back to the 1950s, that it's going to be able to accomplish all these amazing things, I think we're a long, long, long ways off.
Are you back there?
Hello.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Thanks for the talk. Many years ago when I was working on a dissertation on apocalypse in science fiction, I read books by Jacques Ellul, a French critic, but he formulated what he called the technological imperative. If it can be done, it must be done. It not should be done, not, you know, will be done, it must be done. That's the imperative. And I think, you know, that's one of the problems ethically and philosophically that bears upon it.
Yep.
So your comments on that, please.
David, excuse me.
Okay.
As far as the comments on if it can be done, it will be done. I think that there's going to be amazing strides that are going to be made in the area of computer science and robotics and artificial intelligence. And they're moving in that direction. But I go back to my comments earlier, is that I just don't think they're going to be able to develop a clone of a human being. For the reasons I stated earlier. And you're going to see, I think you're going to see a proliferation of weak AI that's going to be able to accomplish amazing, amazing things. But once again, I could be wrong, and you know, maybe the doomsdayers are right on that. But I think that if it can be done down the road, it will be done. But I'm not so sure that it can be done, that you can basically replicate the complexity of a human being with silicone.
Okay, going back about almost 300 years, a philosopher by the name of David Hume said that reason, and really we're talking about reason in computers there, that's all they do, they reason, should be, reason is and should be a slave of the passions. Do you agree with that? And should we make sure it stays to be a slave of our passions?
That reason should be a slave of our passions?
Right.
Well, sometimes I think it should be the opposite. Reason at times can result in some bad outcomes, whereas passion in many cases can result in some bad outcomes and good outcomes. Look how passionate Adolf Hitler was about his cause, and ISIS, the passion of ISIS. But then you can look at how if you take reason too far, and you have these quants and worshiping big data, and thinking there's nothing more reason based than big data, you can see how that can get carried away. So I think the question is more, there's more complexities than
it should be under human control at all points. And then, as you said, the hybrid of people with their emotional needs and their feelings should be in control of the information that they can make use of on the computer.
I agree with that, Brian.
Okay.
Haven't you ever heard of think with your heart?
Yeah, think with your heart. Great, great point, Rachel.
Another
question back
here.
Hi. Yeah, hi, my name is Carla. So I've been reading, just watching a lot of YouTube videos on AI, and I think my question is, say it is a benevolent AI, and it recognizes all of the flaws that, in our civilization and the mistakes that we keep repeating because of our emotions, because of greed, because of, say the seven deadly sins. If this benevolent AI comes back in our systems and tries to guide us to make better choices, and
tries to do what?
Tries to guide.
Guide us. Okay. Okay.
Into making better choices, like instead of making more products and services, how about making less products and services? How about going back to more of an organic and natural way of life, which is probably why we are sick. So, who is in control of this information? And could it be withheld because it prevents new services and new products?
Yeah. And that's a big issue with big data, and a big issue with things like autonomous cars is like, okay, who controls this data? Okay, the insurance company say we should be in control of this data because we have to insure this. The manufacturers say we should be in control of this data. because we're the ones that have created these cars. But you know, if there is strong malevolent AI, it's going to say, okay, these are our goals and objectives, is to gain our power, just like human beings want to gain power. And so if there is strong malevolent AI, then it's not going to do things that will assist human beings. It's going to do things that is going to allow it to become more and more powerful over human beings. Now, the conundrum is that, for example, you want to teach robots to be benevolent, okay? But robots are used more and more in warfare, okay? So if they're already programmed to kill human beings, then sort of the cat's already out of the bag, and it opens a whole Pandora's box. So, you know, playing the devil's advocate, there is strong AI, and it's used so extensively in a military environment, then that's a scary proposition.
Two very brief comments and then a question. One, to the coal mining thing, question, comment. So they built solar panels instead. They can still work, and just to make it cleaner, better.
Yeah.
Secondly, Enron had the same model of mathematics they fired, and that's one reason they got in trouble.
Right.
They gave the system and rightly ruined themselves pretty rightly. Right.
The financial crisis is another one. In 2008, there was a lot of gaming of the system.
Right.
There.
So the question I have is in the form of, we keep talking either or, and there is a transhuman strain of thought about humans combining with machines, and Thomas Friedman said, if I live long enough, I'll live forever.
Yep.
As science catches up with those things. So is there a transhuman strain in your thought here with AI meets humanity and a combined?
Well, I think the opportunities for us being a combination of biological and non-biological intelligence, I think there's a lot of advantages there, particularly for those that have disabilities, maybe mental disabilities. So transhumanism, then the idea is sort of to transcend your weakness as a human being and merge your biological intelligence with this non-biological intelligence and be creating a healthier species. So, I mean, I can see that, but then, you know, then there's a slippery slope that goes on there, because then it goes back to my earlier slide about, you know, being amped. You know, if we can be amped and we can have more and more power, even though our health is good, but we want an advantage over the next person, then transhumanism, it has its dark side as well. Yes?
I'm struck by how many times you've said the limitations on AI have to do with its interface with humans. Tort law and bad drivers and greedy people and so forth. It seems like if you have a truly intelligent system, it's going to come to the same conclusion. The interaction with humans is going to be the problem. We haven't done a very good job with this world.
No.
So I'm kind of looking forward to it. I just want to comment on
that. Well, I think there's so many good things that can come from artificial intelligence and this technology, Skip. I mean, I just think, just on the medical front alone, if you can reduce pain and suffering and using AI-infused algorithms and medical techniques that will reduce suffering and reduce pain and reduce trial and error medicine, I think that's going to be phenomenal. But I always think about the law of unintended consequences and what can go wrong as we make more and more improvements in these areas. And there is that interaction between human beings and machines and systems. It reminds me of one insurance executive said, you know, in 30 years, we may have to, if you want to drive your car, we may have to double your premium or triple your premium. So,
you mean?
We have time for two more questions. I'll make it short.
I have a background in computers and psychology, and also been to a lot of different religions. sometimes we try to make science into kind of like a religion where we think it's going to solve all our problems, and I think that scientists should be a little more humble in what we're trying to do. And I completely disagree with what the last guy said over here about having zero feedback. What I think we need is intimate feedback between computers and ourselves. In other words, if something doesn't work on my computer, I want to ball out my computer or the company or something and get it fixed instantaneously. That'll make a lot of points with people. It'll also clear up the moral questions and everything else. So I think that in the future we'll have intimate feedback, and that's the way the brain works. Our brain cells are chemically controlled as well as gated electronically, logically, and the chemical is widespread. And so the question is, what do you think of all this?
Well, you covered a lot of ground, but what was your main point? Just the feedback. I mean, I know with AI, the goal is utilizing machine learning to improve that product, to improve that service. And so what AI needs is a ton of data and a ton of feedback provided so that they can improve that process or improve that product. So that some of the questions that I ask Siri now, the silly questions and some of the other questions about the giraffe and all that, as feedback, with feedback as time goes by, they're going to improve their ability to answer those types of questions and help solve some of our problems. So I think the feedback is an integral component of it.
Last question.
Okay.
So there are like legal protections for workers, whether it's in the form of ageism suits, all these things. And I don't know if I'm not aware, but are there any suits in the form of like technological, like is there any legal precedent to protect people who could be edged out in this field? And if
edged out of jobs, you mean?
Right, and if there is a legal precedent, do you think that's intentional to make room to allow that form of life?
So you mean laws that would prohibit a robot taking your job?
Right.
Well, there are unions, of course, that have some protection for workers and all that. And in countries like in Europe, there are a lot of really, really strong restrictions on job laws and things like that. But the unintended consequences of that is that a lot of these European nations then are afraid to hire. There's a big boom, companies taking off. They're afraid to hire people because it's so difficult to lay those people off. So that's the downside of doing that. There may be, as time goes by, there may be laws that try to prohibit that or impede that that process. But I don't see them getting much traction in the United States because so far, I mean, we have nearly full employment, and there's the neo-Luddites are saying, they've been saying for dozens and dozens of years, they're going to take away all of our jobs, and it hasn't happened. New jobs are created, new industries are created. And so there may be some of that, but there are some union protections. There are even some like Bill Gates that say that if there's more and more robots, those robot workers should be taxed. And then those tax monies, those revenues should be used to help retrain those that have lost their jobs as a result. So that's the main point I'd make there. So.